Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia visits her parents' home in southern Indiana. Her mother's mental illness is painfully obvious, and Patricia wonders whether Indian black magic is the problem. In her book, The Nurse and the Indians, Eleanor Gregg, an RN appointed just after World War I by the Red Cross to serve the public health needs of the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations in South Dakota, who was eventually appointed by the Department of the Interior as the federal government's first supervisor of public health nursing, writes about her mother's qualms just before Eleanor left for the reservations. "You must have the courage of ignorance," her mother told her. "I failed to call Mom for the first 3 weeks of my tour of duty at Lapway, and she grew worried enough to call the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma trying to locate me. All she knew of Indians were her Cherokee grandparents, so it made sense to start there. Incredibly, during my first visit to the satellite clinic in Kamiai, Amanda Alfred, who was filling in that day for an ill receptionist, stepped up to the circle where I was standing talking to Ellen Barton, Dr. Haskins, Leonard Wahobin, Liddy Yuknovich, and Tamara Olson, and said, 'Your mother's on the phone.' Maybe it was the courage of ignorance that led me through the process of giving Vestal a verbal warning about her conduct, then a written one. I created a home visit flowchart for the nursing assistants, who, in light of tribal self-governance, were no longer under the umbrella of the IHS Community Health Representatives Program, and therefore now reflected a title change to Community Health Nursing Assistants, a fancy little NCR form that required only ticks of a pen to record services rendered during a home visit, one copy of which stayed in my office for data collection purposes, and one in the medical chart to keep doctors abreast of the range of a patient's vital signs and symptoms over time. After comparing the GSA gas log and mileage chart with the new flow charts, it became apparent the GSA was spending its time parked. I brought up Vestal on charges of insubordination and falsifying patient records and lodged a complaint with the Idaho Nurses Association. They would step in if the nursing assistant did not cease and desist. Seated in our tiny meeting room with its teal mini blinds and tasteful oak bookcase, focused on Vestal's gold front tooth and not the medicine bag hanging from her neck, I read the conditions of her termination and offered her the chance to speak. Her black hair was dyed and permed. She must have lost a close family member, which would have necessitated the cutting short of a life's length of hair. Somewhere in her house, just like Esther Whitman, she probably had it rolled and bound and protected in a pillowcase, along with hairs from her hairbrush and those she shed on her pillow at night. Vestal did not speak, only rose, collected a few things from her desk, and left. To recall these next days now brings up the same panic I experienced then, the same brick-hard breathlessness I felt driving over those Oregon highways in the middle of the night looking for Mark and his leggy blonde. And I guess I was vulnerable to such things coming from 200 years of hill people as I do, and millennia of Celts, of Highland Scots. Then there was great-grandma and Grandpa Joe, she a midwife, he a medicine man, Cherokees who hid in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee to avoid the march to Oklahoma, great-great-great-grandma Nancy King and her husband Elijah, runaway slaves who hid in our hollers and practiced the medicine of Africa, not to mention the holy rollers in our line who cast demon and spells to heal the sick. to see myself sitting in a circle with the rest of my staff, talking at that moment about starting a 100-mile club on the Quarter Lane Reservation and maybe a wellness fair, to see one of our mental health social workers walk in, the one named Barbara, who was blonde and lean and proud of the khaki uniform she wore weekends for the Air Force Reserves, to see her angled smile rising out of field boots, handing me that spiral-bound journal, saying, "I ran across this at a conference and thought of you." The way I didn't take it exactly, but the way she put it on my hand so I had to open my palm to it. The way we all sat there for a long second, Bonnie breathing from within a calico shirt with her entire upper body braced as if for pain. Wilhelmina, seat pulled away from the edge of her upholstered cubicle, dark eyes crinkled at the edge of a laft, graying raven hair pulled into a bun, loose strands tricked into place with beaded barrettes, sucking in the slightest bit of air. Paula, heavy enough in the bosom that her beaded medallion dangled off its slope, twisting the head of her stethoscope. Pamela, short hair and stretchy knit pants and clipboard, also seated, her ever-present belly laugh dwindling into a giggle. Susan, dark, rose-colored glasses keeping us from her soul, a gap between the seer and the seen, and as usual, apart from the group a bit, taking it in. And all of us knowing Barbara was Vessel's best friend and being trained in the powers of black medicine. Did I feel anything when I touched that spiral-bound book? Yes and no. I felt both puzzled and flattered, hoping it was a gesture of peace, hoping Barbara was saying, "Let's keep our eyes on the bigger subject." But I also felt a moment of death, and a welling from my fingers that flew up my arm and into my heart, and now it was my soul that looked like mustard. Fortunately for us, Bonnie's father had been a powerful medicine man and often visited her and her mother in dreams. We didn't know it, but Bonnie's mother had just that morning called to warn her a curse was coming to yellow hair shaped like a book. She was not to intercept it because yellow hair needed the lessons she would learn from surviving and instructed Bonnie not to let it touch her skin, lest she be plagued too. She was to grip it with a plastic bag, slip it inside without touching it, secure the package with a rubber band, and leave it in the sweat lodge. Bonnie's mother would sweat and pray for our safe passage and burn the journal there. Somewhere in the middle of this, the facility director, Kurt Lowenstein, received a phone call. A male voice promised, "If we find yellow hair out on the reservation, we'll bring her up to the clinic, dead." A second caller promised, "Dad is going to stop coming to the clinic. When he does, he'll come looking for Patricia Morrison and kill her." Then Bonnie brought the news. The journal had exploded in the sweat lodge, releasing demons and evil spirits. In a dream that night, her father showed her the medicine bag she was to make for me, orange background with a white buffalo, all in glass beads. Within days, my daddy called to tell me about Mom being wheeled away on a gurney in four-point restraints after she emptied all the closets and cupboards onto the floor and threatened him with a knife, ranting about dead Indian babies. She fell into a catatonic state and had to be admitted to a psych hospital where she was neglected to the point of death, until I called the facility's parent company, wielding my status as a commissioned officer with the U.S. Public Health Service, which induced them witlessly to review Mom's medical needs, rheumatoid arthritis, hypoglycemia, chronic hypertension. By the time they got orders to start syringe feeding her Ensure, she had dwindled from 127 to 102 pounds. Daddy said she looked shriveled as a day-old bean, lying there day after day in the same urine-soaked dress. She finally started coming around when Daddy put the phone to her ear so I could talk to her. "Jesus doesn't want you yet," I said. "It isn't your time to go yet, Mom. You've got to eat and drink your Ensure. You've got to take your exercises." "I will," she said, her voice so low in her throat that it sounded like a demon had moved in. "I'll follow it to the letter." Next, Bonnie was diagnosed with diabetes so severe as to require insulin injections, and Paula with rheumatoid arthritis. I came down with an ailment known as systemic candidosis. Overnight, I had severe lung congestion, skin lesions, vaginal yeast, and was forced to be taking powerful antifungal medications at $15 a pill, hard enough on the liver that my liver functions had to be tested each week by blood draw. My diet was limited to meat and boiled potatoes. In a month, I dropped 20 pounds. Pamela dreamed of me sick in bed, covered with sores. I went to build a fire in your wood stove, she said, but I saw you already had a fire. I thought I'd chop you some wood, but you already had plenty of that, too. My sister Dorinda in Atlanta called Daddy in hysterics, telling stories of being awakened by demons hovering around her room. Dad woke one night to a male voice telling him, "Your daughter is dead." It was then he began seeing the settler's family. Bonnie's mother sent instructions in a bag of wild rosebush branches. I was to boil them and bathe in the water. Boiled wild rose bushes smell like rhubarb and turn the water just as red. I filled the bathtub with it and lay under the water until my lungs felt like a scouring pad, submerged myself again and again until the porcelain had sucked all the heat from the water. I smudged my house and car with sweetgrass, sage, and the bark of virgin cedars. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the wind, I am small and weak and need your courage and wisdom. 11:55 p.m. Dad is watching Touched by an Angel on the PAX network. He does this every night. Mom just knocked on my bedroom door to ask about the condition of my soul. I told her I'm a very spiritual person, that the difference in our two belief systems is a matter of language. Belief, I told her, is what matters. Faith in a bigger plan, an intricacy of order that we cannot alone create for ourselves. But Patricia, she said, do you have the baptism? Do you speak in tongues? I do, I told her. What is poetry if not the tongue of the creative spirit? What is the creative spirit if not holy? What is storytelling if not the transcription of a higher realm of self of which I otherwise cannot speak? 12:17 a.m., December 30th. Mom brought me a copy of Dad's insurance policy in case something happens. She told me they have purchased 6 burial plots at the Graceland Cemetery in New Albany, so each of us children can be buried next to them. She said if anything happens to me, they can have my body transplanted back to Indiana. I've been to that graveyard where my Uncle Gus is buried. I've seen the markers for her and my daddy's graves. Delbert Schuyler Morrison, B, 1936. Melba Fay Morrison, B, 1936. I told her I do not want to be buried there. Indiana is not my home. My mother's current diagnosis is schizoaffective disorder, what boils down to acting out, emotion translated into disorganized behavior, most likely the result of deep, long-term depression. She comes by it honestly enough, born prematurely in Depression-era America, descended from hundreds of years of Kentucky subsistence farmers, shack-dwelling mountain people. She is the result of one teenager forcing his blonde-haired, blue-eyed, biological inclinations on a dark-skinned neighbor daughter. At 3.5 pounds, Mom spent the first few months of her life in a shoebox. The little black Indian-haired girl who should have died at birth and didn't, as she now labels herself. A local man later married her mother, Kelty Gooden, although Mom did not know this man was actually a stepfather until some fellow high school students were introduced as her half-brothers, sons of the boy who raped Kelty. The man who had been forcing his sex addiction on my mother during her adolescence, suddenly not her biological father, and suddenly incest, not the name of his crime. "Just do your best to stay away from him," her mother said. "I've got 9 others to look after." But before that year was out, 5 of the 9 were dead of various contagion. One of them, the infant Anita, who was Mom's primary responsibility, lived her meager days in a shoebox too. During her psychosis, my mother wrote in a lined notebook Daddy found later of having been shipped to St. Louis to stay with cousins, where she delivered and relinquished for adoption a baby boy. Now she denies it. Except for her telling me, as I grew up, I always wished you were a boy. I might try harder to believe that repeal. 10:34 a.m., December 31st, New Year's Eve. I don't know what this has to do with anything, but I can't stop thinking about it. There were good people on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, and maybe it was his way of casting a good spell to counteract the bad ones. No way of knowing, but it may be why we are all still alive. His name was Marv Calling Elk, and he is dead now. Heart failure at the age of 45. He was Shoshone, devoted to various art forms, mostly beaded medicine belts and deer hide pouches painted with magic symbols and hand-carved amulets. His specialty, however, was, as his name suggests, a bull elk with neck arched and antlers scraping its spine, muzzle skyward, and darkened lips in a flat rosette shape. They were fantastically detailed and always carved from cedar, which I understand from my brother Delbert is hard work. Even a Suyapi, the Coeur d'Alene word for white person, could feel the blessing and power in those little hand-tooled creatures. Marv's other specialty was teepees. He not only stitched canvas and carved poles and put them together in kits for sale, painted with bright, powerful emblems, but he taught teenagers and young adults to build them. Juveniles in trouble with the law could be sentenced to apprentice in the construction of teepees. A teepee is a hearth, a home. Building a dwelling place is empowering, gives people a sense of control over their existences, makes them part of the community. Marv's theory was that crime is committed out of jealousy. The perpetrator feels jealous over what they don't have or imagine they cannot do, and so lash out against a person or structure or organization that represents what he or she does not have or cannot do. According to traditional thought, crime is a schizoaffective disorder. Is it coincidence that Marv called me just after Mom had been diagnosed and told me it was time for me to come and learn build a teepee? I don't know. I'd referred people to Marv, but I never planned on the experience myself, and he had never invited me. It was the same reason I never went to Longhouse or to the Sweat Lodge. I was just too afraid of what might be expected of me, and so tired of Indian voodoo. Rhonda Denny came, Marv said. It took her 16 tries. 16 tries, I asked. She's Indian, and it took her 16 tries to get the teepee up. Most Indians take 14. Whatever. I liked Marv. He was trained as a social worker and had done lots of good for young people, organizing baseball teams and tournaments. He may have single-handedly kept 90% of Plummer Worley kids out of trouble, which is maybe why I agreed to go. Maybe it was time to step out of that protective shell I'd installed after the divorce, and Vernon, and the trouble with Zach, and the deaths of Uncle Gus and Toby Perez, and the Vestal fiasco. It was risky. There were still those two death warrants hanging over me. Would I learn to build a teepee and live to tell about it? Marv and his wife Carrie lived in a HUD house on the south end of the Coeur d'Alene Reservation. It was furnished with the normal everyday couch and chairs, a coffee table and end tables, and a living room dominated by a large TV. The kitchen and dining area were an open swath of tiled floor, wood cabinets to the ceiling above a formica counter, and an island jutting from the bearing wall that divided kitchen from living area. There was nothing to predict Marv had an ongoing relationship with traditional culture, other than a miniature teepee on a grass-green base. Marv showed that version to me first, so I could get a general idea of the construction. Carrie, a blonde Suyapi, offered me tea, which I refused. "Are you sure?" Marv asked. "It's mountain tea." meaning, of course, it was Kinnikinick, gather the nearby mountains and dried on mats in the sun. I'd sipped it at the root feast in Lapway. Clearly the tea was an agent for my afternoon's endeavor, so I accepted. He lifted an eyebrow at Carrie, who poured tinged liquid for each of us into white porcelain cups. The fluid was lovely, sitting on my tongue for just a moment before settling into my throat, earthy and golden. Perhaps it was my imagination, but it did make me feel strong-hearted. I put on my jacket at Marv's suggestion, and we stepped out the sliding glass door.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree.
Patricia and her nursing staff on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation are the focus of a black medicine curse. To counteract it, a social worker named Marv Calling Elk invites her to learn how to construct a teepee. How did I manage to build a teepee on that first try, herringboned and lashed to the poles at their pointed ends, drape the shaped fabric and tug the rope, pulling the herringbone aloft to form the peak of the roof and the smoke hole? To move inside the hollow tip and kick the poles out to the appropriate distance? The structure fell in place as if I had designed it. Inside the teepee was peaceful nothingness. Outside I lashed stakes, pushed and pulled until the canvas was taut and the lower edges equidistant and parallel to the ground. The two longest poles Marv had moved aside now had a proper place. I slipped them into the plackets at the tallest peak of the canvas where they provided support for the smoke hole and ballast for the door flaps. I finished the chore and turned to Marv, who stood there with his arms folded across his chest, his mouth a firm line, his denim shirt and jeans perfecting the silhouette of this modern-day Indian man. I said it once, and I'll say it again. It takes most Indians at least a dozen tries to build these things. You've done it perfect the first time. Marv did not speak another word. We went back into the house and he handed me the miniature. All ready? Carrie said, looking from Marv to me and back again. 12 noon. I feel like Daddy is begging time not to pass. Two things a woman never gets over: rape and the death of a child. And so these are the secrets my mother held from me, the same ones I hold from Zach and Brett, the questions they will never know to ask. 3:45 p.m., packing to leave. Mom insists she is not sick. I can hear her at the back of the house, noises coming from her throat like those I've heard from Tuareg women in the movies, a trill of warning magnified by the hollows of a practiced pharynx. Danger! Danger! The assonance and alliteration rises and falls. Guilt. There was a time when I swooned over the likes of Jimmy Swaggart and T.L. Osborne, cried at the altar, let preachers lay hands to heal me, danced in the spirit, got slain out. Like Susan's rose-colored glasses, the difference between what was behind my eyes and what people were seeing. I want to tell Mom I took back my soul from Jesus because I needed it, because I felt empty without it, that my own will has been my salvation. But then, of course, following one's own will is a sin of the devil. I'd argue that my soul is free, or at least working toward that goal. She'd argue it is she who is truly free, free in Jesus. Besides, she likes pulling her closets and cupboards into the middle of the room and then cleaning, putting back, and starting over again. She likes marking her belongings with the pretty labels people send to her free of charge. She is proud of sending her tithe, 10% of her disability pension, to worthy evangelists like Pat Robertson. It doesn't bother her at all that she's not been out of the house in 6 months, that she speaks to no other humans except family members and a few spirit-filled friends over the phone. I tried to tell her I met the old-time evangelist T.L. Osborne's grandnephew, that he's a mill worker in Idaho, that he's the grandson of T.L. Osborne's brother, who went through life with hooks for hands but who's known locally for repairing bronze sculptures and vintage bridge railings, that T.L. Osborne's grandnephew can start a fire from flint and moss just like the Indians used to do. It was from T.L. Osborne's grandnephew's buddy that I learned the stars. I dated Harp, a former Indiana boy and truck driver who works at the Potlatch Mill in Lewiston for years off and on, our courtship revolving around issues of Astronomy magazine, a white flashlight for pointing out constellations, and a red-lensed one for reading star maps, the red lens meant to keep us from losing our night vision. What a comfort to revisit those configurations on summer nights, lounging on an air mattress in the back of his pickup on the flats above the Snake River, Cassiopeia, Scorpio, Hercules, Bootes, Corona Borealis, Draco, Delphinius. They never change. Although once we saw two stars suddenly zip away, but turned out they were only iridium flares from satellites. Midnights during August in Idaho, when high mountain chill hints at the temperatures to come, there are stars so plentiful as to upstage the notion of constellations anyway. It all looks like glitter dust, making it easy to imagine new ones. Which I guess is what keeps me looking up there, waiting to see what I'm going to come up with next. I hope I'm rafting the Colorado River when I'm my mother's age, moving to the smaller seas of the salmon in a kayak when I'm 80, rolling over and riding myself, refusing in the worst of waters to let myself be drowned. Maybe my punishment for leaving my mother will be to change her diapers and spoon-feed her when she's 104. But then, as Keats said, it takes a world of pains and sorrows to school an intelligence and make it a soul. In that case, perhaps I will have done us both a favor. 7:50 a.m. Central Time Zone, January 1st, 2001, first day of the new millennium, Minneapolis, Minnesota. The road home. The one thing I loved was going for White Castle hamburgers and to watch Tom Hanks' new movie, Cast Away, with my brother Delbert and his wife Dinah. Delbert has given up his job at a glass factory and is driving long haul. It is partly my fault. I told him about Goethe, who said, "Be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid." Delbert opened his own woodcraft shop and called it Goethe's, and almost went bankrupt before he found out the state of North Carolina would pay him to go to truck driving school. It's too bad. He's very good. If you order a door or a piece of furniture from him, he buys a permit and goes to the mountains and searches until he finds the right tree from which to mill the lumber. For him, wood has a soul, and woodworking is spiritual. Delbert's relationship with Mom is different than mine and Dorinda's. Mom fawns over him. He seeks her advice. Took her in while Daddy was in rehab after his stroke/snake bite. For me, understanding Mom is a juggle jargon. Hypertension, rheumatoid arthritis, her dancing nystagmus, paranoia, hallucinations, obsessive compulsive disorder, club foot, towing in, genu verum, hyperreligiosity, history of chemical dependency and prolonged sexual abuse, the social and developmental risks associated with poverty and prematurity, and now schizoaffective disorder. Damn it, I'm hurt to have lived my life without her. Babies, tonsillectomies, Zach's 10 days in the ICU, chickenpox, Christmases, marriages, divorces. True, I left her, but why didn't she follow me? Why didn't she beg me to come back? 4:05 p.m., Fargo, North Dakota, where a bus station prophet once warned me of the dangers of breeding computer chips with DNA. And why did she give in to disease? Why did she not fight it, crawl out from under the fog of fate and boost herself into the firelight? Where is her will? Why does she quiver in the face of life? Why isn't she pissed at having drawn the short straw? Maybe her lips are missing muscles, contorted from speaking only sounds and unattached syllables. Maybe she is flat missing the nerve that runs between heart, brain, and mouth. Otherwise, wouldn't she ask, "How is your love life? Want to go for lunch?" 7:45 p.m., Bismarck, North Dakota. A young woman just discovered the man across the aisle is her uncle. Within an hour, they are making out under a blanket. 6:50 p.m., January 2, 2001, Casper, Wyoming, near where Matthew Shepard was killed. The man who raped Grandmother Kelty was named Holly Shepard. The gray-haired woman who's been softly snoring next to me since Cheyenne finally spoke just after midnight. We exchanged the brief details of our travels and then quieted again. She is a retired nurse, on her way to meet her mother and daughter in Missoula, Montana. They are all driving together through the building-high snowdrifts of Lolo Pass and the zigzag Bitterroots to pick up another sister in Lewiston, Idaho, then to spend the weekend in Spokane, taking in Stars on Ice. I tell her I've only been once with my two sons years ago to watch Beauty and the Beast, and then I tell her about them. Tall, bright, 120 and engaged to be married, the youngest 17, towering over his brother in height and expectations. 10:25 a.m. Mountain Time Zone, Missoula, Montana, January 3, 2001. I've been across the country and back, and not once has the landscape been devoid of snow. The entire north from Washington to Kentucky is sporting an excess of a foot of snow. Two more women, each wearing brown suede jackets and cowboy boots, board the bus, headed to Spokane for a night at the Ridpath Hotel and Stars on Ice. I tell them about my seatmate who just got off on her way to the same show. The one sitting next to me says this is the first trip she has taken since her mother died last year. We did everything together, she said, and I just had a hard time getting out and going on without her. 6:00 p.m. Pacific Time Zone, Moscow, Idaho. Zach is waiting for me at the Royal Motor Inn in the now beat-up Civic, the car I bought new in 1991 at the onset of my career with the Indian Health Service. Blue-jeaned girls, likely college students, mill around the front desk. He sucks in his waist and draws on a cigarette, exaggerating his 6'4" muscle-under-baby-fat physique. A junior in high school, he's a theater major, sings lead in a college band known as Optimus Prime, and has aspirations as an attorney. If he doesn't first go to acting school in New York, he hugs me, asks, "How was your trip, Mom?" Then begins talking about his own Christmas vacation with Mark and the new step family in Reno, augmented by 4 days in Puerto Vallarta, his first time outside the United States borders. He talks about drinking daiquiris in their condo, smoking Cuban cigars. I gasp, and he begs me not to go crazy. It was Mexico, and it was vacation, and it was his father. I want, for some reason, to use this moment to tell him about a little girl, a girl who would have been his sister, a golden-haired child of now 10 on her way to 11. I want to explain how it feels to hear the words, "I'm not up to it," from my husband, his father. I want to tell him how it feels to hear the words, "Your daddy's had a stroke." I want him to know how lucky he is to have a mother whose heart is belligerent and steadfast in trying to rid itself of its fetters. But I do none of it. That very same heart, too busy clutching against the speed at which he rounds the corner, and agree to opening our presents tonight instead of tomorrow night, as previously planned. "It's about time," he says, driving under the early dark and the Idaho streetlights casting their wheat-colored auras against the snow, although better a belated Christmas than no Christmas at all. He talks on, while I cushion my head against the headrest, close my eyes and glimpse 4,800 miles of America rolling under the tires of a Greyhound bus. Somewhere in their circular rhythm is Moose's story of the seven directions and the pathway to freedom, and the storehouse of questions I fear I will never know to ask. Jesus and the Hand of Bitten Grapes, Heart. May 23, 2001, Eagle Cap Wilderness, Oregon. I suppose I disappointed people when I left Lapway, but they still had held 5 going-away parties, including the vegetarian potluck at which Moose presented a deer-hide drum and sang an ancient Nez Perce blessing. The tradition when anyone leaves the Nez Perce or the Coeur d'Alenes is to award a Pendleton blanket. Moose and Leonard Wehoben were in charge of this, but I told them Stan and Peach Franklin had already given me one and that I would love to have one of Elmer Joe's drums. This is when I learned that Elmer never returned from Oregon, but died there from complications of that broken hip. Co-workers up north in Plummer, however, were angered by my resignation, and it was difficult to walk away from the teal carpet and raspberry accents, Indian paintings and bronze artwork decorating the halls and foyers. I created a form called Rate the Rooster, which I distributed with my annual evaluation packet. It asked staff to rate my handling of various details of the job. Their anonymous responses gave me opportunity to figure ways to whittle my skills. Someone got hold of a blank form and scrawled across it in huge black magic marker letters, "You've taken us this far, and now you leave." It is also safe to say I've often wished I had not headed down this narrow, dark trail of the writer. The trees are gnarly and hunched and don't allow the sun through. It is 5,000 times more intimidating than going to a job where your only task is to persuade a community of people to love themselves enough to adopt healthful habits and to find individual voices so they won't manifest their emotions through self-destruction. I think of those women who stood around me in that newspaper photograph announcing my arrival in the Coeur d'Alene Reservation. I see me, blonde and smiling. I see Wilhelmina hidden behind dark glasses, her smile large. I see Paula looking tentative but happy. I see Susan, effervescent with a smile just a little too ready to donate itself. And Bonnie, beadwork stark against her chest, stoic, but as with my grandmother, Kelty, also in judgment. What these women saw in me, I'll never know, but they took me in like a butterfly, wet and new, embraced me as though they'd been waiting for me a long, long time. I broke their trust and feel bad for it. Women have been choosing to abort their babies since women have been getting pregnant. Herbs such as pennyroyal and black cohosh usually do the trick. When Mark and I found out Anna had spina bifida, I tried taking pennyroyal. I drank cup after cup, but only spotted a tiny bit. Mark said, "I can't do this." Insurance paid for the abortion. The procedure itself was simple. I lay on a table with my feet in the stirrups while Margaret, LPN, placed an IV line and filled it with Versed. "A nice drug," she said. "You won't remember a thing." Soft rock played in the background. I looked down the length of my flat belly, felt myself slip away. From between my knees and behind the drape, Dr. Breitenbusch said, "The machine is loud. You're going to have some cramps." Margaret held my hand. Her smock was flowers and pink. The overhead lights were white. I imagined the stormy ground of my uterus, the disappointment of my fallopian tubes. We worked so hard, only to come to this.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.